This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Lead Singer Syndrome is brought to you by Loot Crate. Head over to lootcrate.com/leadsinger and enter promo code LEADSINGER to save $3 off your first subscription.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. So good to have you with us on this fine Monday morning or whenever you're listening to this. As always, my name is Shane Told. I am your host on a podcast where I speak to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman, in this case, front man, of a professional rock and roll band. And this week we have a great episode. I speak to my very old friend, Vic, from Pierce the Veil. My band Silverstein, we were just on tour, actually, with Pierce the Veil in Australia. We tried to hook up to do a podcast then. We were going to actually do it on an airplane, which would have been kind of interesting. Unfortunately, you know, Australian tours are really short. It's a small country. It's a big country, but it's a small country. Only played like 5 markets there or something. So it was too quick, in and out. But I'm really happy we got to connect today because Vic is one of the best dudes, one of the best singers, one of just the best all-around musicians we have in this punk scene of ours. Before we get into it, I want to remind you guys, we have like 60-something back episodes. So subscribe to this show if you're not already. Go back, listen to some of the old episodes. Some of them are really good, but we got some great episodes coming up in the future as well. So I am really excited. 2017 is going great for me already. I have to tell you guys about my New Year's resolution. I am 3 weeks in, and I have lost 8.5 pounds. Pretty good, huh? Yeah, it's pretty good. I'm eating a lot of bagged salad, which I am enjoying, I think. Also, if you guys have any New Year's resolutions and you're getting to the point where it's like, uh-oh, I need a little help, I'm here for you. I can be your buddy. Send me an email. I love when people get in touch with me. The show email is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter, which is @leadsingersyn, S-Y-N. And we're on Instagram, @leadsingersyndrome. We got a Facebook page, all that stuff. But what I really want to tell you about is the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. Now, this show is free. It will always be free. And I will put out an episode just about every Monday until the world explodes, which could be sooner or later with Mr. Donald Trump president. Welcome to the White House, Mr. Trump. Fuck my life. But if you're one of those people where one episode a week, it just might not be enough for you. Some people are really into this show. So if you want to get more bonus content, if you want to interact with other fans of the show and myself on our private Facebook group, which is popping off, by the way, if you want to get exclusive Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise, if you want to get signed stuff mailed to your house, we're starting up to do some contests on there, which is really cool. Also, a little bonus monthly Q&A session with me. I play some tunes. We have a good time on there. If you can contribute as little as $6 a month, you can be a member and join us and really help us keep the lights on with this show. It really is a good time. So check out leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. That will take you to the All Access Club homepage. You can just check it out, read about it, see if it's right for you. And of course, all your support goes a real long way in helping this thing grow. So thank you so much to everybody that's already joined. Shout outs to my sinners. And I hope everybody else checks that out as well. Anyways, I'm going to keep the intro short and sweet. I will talk to you after my conversation with Vic of Pierce the Veil. Maybe we're just having so much fun. Dude, so good to have you, man.
Hey.
We're doing it. We're doing it. We've been talking about doing this for a little while.
This is happening.
Now this is happening. It's like that that scene in Anchorman where Jack Black kicks the puppy.
Now this is happening.
Which is appropriate because I imagine you're in San Diego right this moment.
I am. I'm in my backyard. Right now.
Dude, do you know how jealous I am that you can be in a backyard right now?
Oh, yeah.
Because I cannot be in a backyard. I mean, I could if I, like, wanted to put on my parka and my, like, long underwear, you know, but...
Yeah.
Dang, dude. No, that's great. That's great. So you're just hanging out? What's new with you, just life-wise?
Let's see. What's new? Well, you know, we just got off of, like, 6 months of touring. release of our most recent record, Misadventures. So we just been kind of working that like crazy, and it was, you know, once the holidays kick, everybody kind of takes a break and does, you know, the New Year's Eve and Christmas hangs and stuff. Yep. So kind of just been doing that, and then just kind of gearing up to head up to Canada in a couple weeks here.
I see that. That is my motherland. So that's perfect, man. Yeah. So with your record, Misadventures, I mean, it's very well documented that the record took a fucking long time to actually
yes.
come out. And before we get into the reasons why, you know, mm-hmm. now that it's out and you've been touring on the record for like, you know, 6 months straight. How do you feel about the record now? Did it kind of do what you wanted it to do? Were the songs popping up off live? Like, how do you feel about the record when you've had a little time to kind of sit on it?
Man, it's been, it's cool. Cause you know, every record you do, you kind of, it's like watching your kid grow up or something. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you can like, you like, don't know what it's, you know, what it's going to look like, what, you know, what kind of personality it's going to take on, you know, it's cool to see a record develop on its own and cause you know, you make your piece of art, you know, and you feel really proud about it and you just, you never know what people are going to respond to. So it's been awesome to, you know, get out on the road and, you know, see, you know, people singing the songs and playing them is just, almost therapeutic now that you know you've worked so hard on creating them. It's like it's really nice to actually play them.
No, it's so great. It's fantastic.
Yeah, man, it's been super fun, and you know, this record's also brought on a lot of new things for our band, which is always nice to keep challenging yourself with. You know, like this is the first record we've ever had any sort of radio play, so
right,
that's been you know, sort of new for you know, just for our band in general, and so yeah, it's been fun. I like having, you know, new challenges and experiences.
Yeah,
every record,
that's cool. Now I noticed the radio thing a little bit, just kind of looking, you know, through like chart history and being like, oh, crazy, this, you know, your last single had some play, and it's funny because, you know, our bands have been around a long time, and actually Silverstein, we're getting the first radio play we've ever had up here in Canada. Like,
yes.
Legitimate radio play. So it's funny how, like, it's like these, I don't want to call them like dinosaurs, but it's like, you know, the people that care about music are the people that are like on the ground level that are finding out about these bands. And they're typically not the people that are like listening to the radio on the way to work. Do you know what I mean? Because those people,
totally.
Those people that care about music are listening to podcasts on their way to work, but we won't get into that. but what I'm trying to say is like, sometimes it really takes these people in radio a long time to notice, oh shit, people, like kids like this band and this band is good. So was the road to this kind of having some success, was it a difficult road? Have you guys been trying for a long time?
No, honestly, like, you know, we've always taken our band with really slow steps and, you know, to be perfectly honest, radio was never, an option for us, or even like a thought in our head most of the time growing up, because we're in like punk band, you know, a punk band.
Sure.
And like,
I know.
So
I
it's
get
like
it, man.
you know, you grow up thinking like, you know, that's not really your focus. Your focus is the shows, you know, going to, you know, touring as hard as you can and playing as many shows as you can. And that's what's cool is because, you know, our band still, you know, have that mentality of still touring like crazy. So, you know, when I say that we have like this radio stuff going on, it's basically like throwing new elements into the mix, like doing different kind of shows and playing for, you know, audiences who haven't been following us for 10 years, you know, like just random people who hear us randomly. And so I think it's been really cool because I like feeling like, you know, like a new band again sometimes, you know, when you're first starting out and working your songs to people who don't know you. It's like that feeling again.
So absolutely. That is a cool thing. It's funny, you miss the early days of like touring in a van and playing to 50 kids. Cause like, you know, those are always the kind of like, you know, the crazy times and you look back with fondness, but like,
yeah,
it's nice to go back, but you don't want to go like all the way back, just a little bit of the way back.
Yeah, exactly.
But being, you know, being a punk band and being a punk rock kid, how did it feel to be like, oh shit, we have a gold record? Like that must have been a trip. Congratulations, dude. By the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, man. It's pretty crazy. You know, I'm always the kind of guy that I don't know, people have to sort of tell me to, I don't know, like enjoy the moment, you know, that you've been given a gold record for this album and you worked really hard and enjoy it, you know, and you know, sometimes
have
I'm always
Corona
just kind
or
of,
something.
Yeah, I'm always kind of thinking about the next record, you know, so it's, but it is nice to see that because there was a lot of, you know, it was a great time making that record, and we put a shit ton of work into it, and we also had a lot of great people involved in making it. So, you know, people like my friends like Brian Southall or
I know B South very well,
yeah, or Jason Alon from Let Live and Kellen Flynn from Sleeping with Sirens, sure. And my friend Curtis Peoples who helped co-write. You know, one of my best friends that I've known since I was 15 helped co-write. You know, our gold single. And so it was like a lot of people involved as well, so which made it even more special. And then I'm getting a lot of phone calls from all these people saying, oh my god, I just got a gold record at my doorstep, you know. So
yeah. Well, that's cool that you guys are, or Fearless, whoever, was able to make, you know, gold records. I had Sierra K from, you know, from Versa Merge, and I asked her, I was like, did you ever get the Day to Remember gold record? And they're like, no, never got one sent to me. And I'm like, really? And I'm like, oh, well, it was Victory. That makes sense.
This is true.
But that's
this
awesome. No, I did see Brian Southall's record, I think, on Instagram, gold record.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that's nice. That's a nice little a little piece, and like, it's really nice to see friends doing well, and that's,
yeah,
that's terrific, yeah. Dude,
thank you, brother.
So I want to talk about your beginnings. You guys have had such an interesting career, and part of why I wanted to have you on the show is just to talk about that, like the ups and downs of your band and where you are now. Mm-hmm. It's a really cool story, but before we get to that, like, you grew up in San Diego. I know there's a little bit about your early life kind of documented, but take me back. Like, how did you get into music? And you know, obviously you and your brother playing together is a cool thing too. So I guess your family must be really involved with your career.
Yeah. Yeah. They've, you know, I think it would be tough for any band to really start out in the very beginning, without, you know, somebody helping you out. Like,
sure. I think so.
You know, like somebody's got to help you pay for those, you know, flyers that you're passing out or those CDs that you were burning back in the day. And, but I mean, yeah, so we came from a musical family. You know, my dad was my dad's A's a guitar player. You know, he plays mostly like jazz and blues and rock and roll, and he kind of, you know, came from the 70s, and he's a hippie. And
are you a better guitar player than your dad?
No, which sucks.
He's still better than you.
I can't believe your father. Dude, honestly, I never will, because he's a different type of player than
sure,
I am. You know,
sure,
he's,
of course.
I'm the kind of guy that can like learn every single note in a song and like, you know, really perfect things, and he's a little more soulful and plays, you know, he can't play the same thing twice, you know what I mean? Because it all comes from inside of him. And you know, we're just different types of players, but he did teach me, you know, everything from the beginning. And he taught me a lot of like jazzy stuff in the beginning, which I think in Spanishy kind of stuff, which I think kind of shaped a little bit of, you know, my background.
I like
as
that
a
word
musician.
Spanishy.
Yeah.
Like
yeah. You know, because, you know, he loves like Santana and stuff like
sure,
that.
Man,
and,
sure.
And over the years I got into that stuff as well. And, so yeah, you know, we came from a, you know, very supportive musical family. We still practice at my parents' house. Like we built a legit, studio. You know, it started off as like the garage, and then
cool,
you know, and then we tore all that down and actually built a legit studio at their house. So, you know, when we rehearse for tours, we actually still go over to my parents' house, which
do
is
they
cool.
come in and tell Jaime to turn down the bass?
That, no,
was always,
they...
that was always my favorite. You know, like when you're practicing, I guess it's different in California because you don't really have basements, but we'd right. practice like in the basement, and you know, the bass wasn't even that loud, but it's like the thing that shakes the whole house.
Oh yeah.
And my mom would come down with like tomato sandwiches or like cookies, and she'd be like, "Sounds great, guys. Is it possible just to turn the bass down a little bit? It's shaking the plates off the wall."
It's like the Weezer "Say It Ain't So" video where the mom comes in doing laundry, like, and then yeah. just like leaves them alone. It's great. Yeah, I mean, that's my dad comes in and sits in on practices and just like rocks out to, you know, the parts, and
that's
you
so
know,
sick.
Gives funny suggestions, and it's great.
That's great. Yeah, no, that's awesome. So yeah, so your parents have been really supportive. So do you have some early bands, early punk rock bands and stuff growing up? Like mm-hmm. what were the bands that really made you be like, okay, I need to like play rock music and like I need to do this myself?
Yeah, I guess I mean, some of the first shows I went to you know, growing up were probably mostly fast punk bands, you know, like all the Epitaph and Fat Records bands. Yeah. I was super into them, you know, being from Southern California.
Oh, dude,
that was
but
big...
I was in Toronto too. Like it was a phenomenon,
yeah.
you know?
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I like, mean, it was, yeah, like, that, I love that stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. The other day they, I don't know if you saw on Facebook, everyone was posting like the top 10 records from that influenced them in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't make a list cause fuck that. But I saw somebody posted as their number one record, the Survival of the Fattest comp.
Yeah,
do you remember that Fat Records comp? And to me, that was probably the most influential record for me.
Yeah, yeah, that and then the Punkaramas were
yeah, exactly,
were great. The,
exactly.
Those compilations where, you know, they would just have tons of Epitaph bands, or you know, they would put their best bands on there, their favorite song, and pass it out at Warped Tour, and then that was like your playlist for the next, you know,
absolutely.
Few months. Yeah, so I got into that in the beginning, and I always had kind of like a split life as far as like my musician, you know, my bands went. When I was a kid, I always had a band with my brother where we played fast punk, and then I had a band with my best friend Curtis who I was just speaking about, who is still, you know, I still write songs with. Him and I, you know, started more of like a, we would play music influenced more by like Stone Temple Pilots or Third Eye Blind and Pearl Jam and stuff like that. So we always had like a little more rock and roll band, and then I would have my punk band. So it was like I would, you know, be able to satisfy those, you know, those both styles of music that I loved. And and then, you know, I think that's kind of also what helped shape Pierce the Veil was
absolutely.
You know, was learning how to play those types of music and then kind of combining them.
No, that's cool, man. That's cool. So, you guys started. So when you guys started getting to be good, like being a good band, you know what I mean? There's a point where, as a kid, you're like, okay, we don't suck. Like, we can probably play a show, and maybe people will like us. Like, when did that happen? And were you always trying to be a singer, guitar player, or were you just trying to be a guitar player?
Yeah, I started off. Just as a guitar player for a while. And then when me and Mike started playing in a band together, we, you know, I knew that I could kind of carry a tune. And, so that was like, you know, that's how you pick your singer. Basically. Can you,
absolutely.
Can you make any noise out of your mouth? Like, okay, good. Let's go. And, So yeah, that's how that started. You know, and as far as like, when did you feel like you're getting good? I was like, I have a theory about that is you always think you're good, like in the moment, you know, like you think you're amazing. Like you record your demo and you think it's the best thing on earth. And then 5-10 years later, you look back on it and you're like, oh my God, like I was, you know, what were we doing? And, so
that's
I'll probably,
funny.
Think,
that's a very good probably, theory.
Yeah, I'll probably think that about the music I'm making now in like 10 years. I'll be like, what the fuck? but in the moment, you're really stoked on what you're doing. And that's what's important, really, honestly. That's like what drives, you know, people to create stuff. And you're just like loving what you're doing. So, yeah, that's kind of how that goes for me.
So when did you guys decide, okay, like, let's take a shot at this. Like, let's go get a van. Let's do some shows.
Yeah.
You know, like, when did that thing happen when you're like, okay, we're gonna start taking this seriously, we're not just gonna be kids, you know, playing in my parents' garage?
It happened the day that we got signed to a record deal. I don't know how you guys got signed, but ours was so like cliche. Like the record label guy came out to the show, took us out to dinner, and said, do you guys want to do a record deal with Equal Vision Records?
Was it Dan?
It was Dan and Steve. They both came out
crazy.
And the owners of Equal Vision and in New York, and they flew out to San Diego. They you know, they kind of heard word of mouth that we had a following, and you know, we were like selling out local shows, you know, doing really well in San Diego. So so they came out and saw us, and thank God that show went well, and and then, you know, they literally just asked us that night, and so that was, you know, that thing, that's when things changed. You know, I dropped out of school because we started touring a lot.
Yeah, so you hadn't really toured before that.
No, I mean, we were just like a local band, and you just kind of like, you're loving playing, but you never actually know if it'll ever happen, you know what I mean?
Right.
Will we ever get that chance or that opportunity to actually make this a career? And thank God that, you know, that happened for us.
Well, you also where you started the band, you have a good benefit of being in a, you know, Southern California where there's a shitload of people, there's a shitload of venues and there's places to play. Like, or were you guys really just like sticking around San Diego? Like, did you guys play LA and Orange County and all that?
Yeah. No, you're totally right. You know, being from San Diego, it's such a very supportive city as far as music goes. You know, there's shows all the time and tons of people to go to them and tons of high schools and tons of kids. And, so that was really helpful. But we couldn't get outside of San Diego. It's actually really hard to get outside of San Diego if you're not, you know, you know, if you don't have any sort of following anywhere else. Like,
right,
I guess maybe back then it was harder because there was no internet or anything for people to hear you, I guess. So, for us, it was really difficult. You know, like the furthest we could get was like playing the Chain Reaction in Anaheim, and that was like the coolest thing ever, just to get out of your town.
Legendary venue, that's for sure.
Yeah, man. So, you know, we might have played there like once or twice, but it was really difficult. They wanted you to sell tickets and in LA, and you're right. I don't know anybody in LA, you know. So it was kind of tough to get out until we actually got signed and started touring and opening up for other acts, you know.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's funny you say how you asked kind of how our story was of getting signed. Almost exactly the same thing. We'd sent demos to different labels, like 3-song CD demos. And we were actually kind of funny because our band, it's still kind of like this. Like, we have heavy songs and we have like softer songs.
Yeah.
So we cherry picked and we sent like the heavier songs to the heavier labels and the softer songs to the softer labels. Like, we had a drive through was interested in us, and we'd sent them like all our like more pop punk songs.
Right.
And then when they wanted to hear the rest of them, they were like, yeah, no, not for us. So that was fine. You know, it was fine. But Victory pretty much called Rick right away and was like, same thing. Tony, the owner of Victory, came to Toronto, watched us play, took us out to breakfast. And that was it. And then we got the deal, and we were the same. We'd only toured a little bit in Canada, like in our kind of shitty van, and we'd played local shows. Like, we'd never been to the US. We'd never, you know, done anything serious. So that's funny, you know, how we have, I guess that's just of that era.
Yeah, maybe it is. You know, maybe that's just the old school way of how they signed it, like an indie band, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was, I don't know. I mean, it was super exciting for us. I don't know. Like, what were you doing in your life? Like what did you uproot to like keep going, like to be in a band?
I was going to university. Yeah,
I was okay,
going,
yeah. I was so going was I.
To, yeah, you were going to San Diego State, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you were in what year were you in? Like what year I was, of school?
I finished my third year, so I was so like funny. I was pretty close to graduating, and yeah. Never did.
Me too, man. Yeah. I did. I was in my first semester of my third year.
Yeah,
and at Christmas, yeah, I finished my semester in Christmas. I pretty much failed a good chunk of my classes because I couldn't focus on school. Are you kidding me? I'm about to make a record on Victory, which is like my favorite label. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I couldn't focus on school, and then yeah, I never went back. I did 2.5 years.
Yeah.
So it's really funny how we're like almost exactly the same.
What were you studying?
I was studying science. Molecular biology, I guess, was my major.
That's
about
crazy.
You?
Yeah. I was trying to be a graphic designer. You know, I was always
cool.
into art and I knew I wanted to do some sort of art and so that it kind of helped. It was kind of cool. I still use that part of my brain, you know, still like, you know, working on all the art that we do, any sort of album designs, t-shirts, like whatever it is. You know, in the early days, I started off doing all of our merch and designing all that stuff in the beginning. But then, you know, we met a lot of people who were much better than I am at it. So,
right. And, you know, the focus changes too on like, you know, your day to day, you know, kind of life and stuff. But no, I'm sure like some of the art direction you guys do, and especially with your live shows, I always like, you know, the things you set up, you know, in terms of your live show. I don't know if you must have a hand in that.
I mean, we do all of it, like 100%. You know, everything comes from like little sketches that we make in band practice. Like, we'll draw it, you know, and
draw your
set
stage
up a little,
and set up. And yeah.
You know, it's straight up like we'll make little dioramas of like what we think the stage might look like and send them to, you know, the real deal people who can build it. And that's, you know, I think that's how any of this stuff starts. But yeah, you know, we still stay completely 100% hands on all of our.
Yeah.
All of our stuff.
No, that's awesome. And I think this all stems from the next thing I want to talk about is for you guys, it really has been like slow and steady wins the race, you know, pardon the adage. But because I remember you guys coming up and I heard your record on Equal Vision, the first record, mm-hmm. and I absolutely loved it.
I heard it
very early on. Like I might have heard it before it even came out. Like I had like a promotional copy or something, and I was right away. I was like, "This band is going to be huge. Like this band is great." And I remember like, I remember being at Equal Vision at Merch Now, and we were getting a bunch of like they were letting us kind of walk through and grab whatever shit you know we wanted.
Oh, yeah.
And
those are the best. Those were the best days.
Oh, I know. And it's funny because I remember I had like I was all stoked on your Padres, you know, rip off baseball tee.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, my band is like. You know, with as much Converge merch as they can carry. and I'm like, my band's like, Pierce the Veil. I'm like, you haven't heard of this band? Like, you haven't heard this band? This band is like amazing. And they're like, oh, no, I haven't heard it. And I was like, and I remember talking to Dan, I think, when we were there. And he was kind of like, yeah, like, I don't really get it why this band isn't popping off. Like, we're trying. We're doing everything we can.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, I think that was after that we, you know, we ended up, hearing I played you for the guys and then you know we brought you guys out on tour, but that was like 2008 and it took you guys a really long time to I mean obviously to get where you are now, but even just to get kind of anywhere where you could do like decent sized headlining shows.
Yeah man it was a long road and you know a lot of opening up mostly in the beginning, and you know I mean when we first started the only bands we could tour with were other bands on Equal Vision, you know, and our booking agent, our first booking agent, who is still our booking agent, Dave Shapiro, who was, he worked,
exclusively for EVR
you know,
at the beginning.
Yeah. He worked at, you know, as Equal Vision's in-house booking agent to book all their bands. Yeah. And that was right out of him, leaving his band Count the Stars, who was on Victory as well. So he, you know, started booking us with just, you know, Fear Before the March of Flames and Code 7 and all these like
bands. Oh my God, I love Code 7.
Yeah, they're amazing.
They're a great band.
So yeah, we toured with all our you know, our family bands, and then kind of started branching out from there. But yeah, you know, it was you know, playing coffee shops and Chinese food restaurants, you know, like
actually, you know, like you actually played a Chinese food restaurant.
I think our first show ever was at a Chinese food restaurant, and lots of playing to very little crowds, and then slowly getting bigger and bigger, and then finally having the confidence to take the risk and do your own tour, you know.
Absolutely. I talk about 2008 when you guys jumped on. I forget what happened. You guys kind of jumped on last minute, and it was us, which is it's a hilarious lineup now to talk about. It was us headlining with the Devil Wears Prada, Day to Remember, mm-hmm. and you guys.
Yeah.
Which, if you guys want to do that tour again, I mean, I'd be more than happy to open.
Dude, that would be so. We can just swap out every night.
Sure, whatever.
That wasn't the Chillers tour, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. Bros in the Snow. That's right.
Yeah, dude. Bros in the Snow.
Yeah, we had a little robot guy wearing a beanie, and
I have that. I made a little. This is kind of shameful, but I made a little framed my band passes. You know, like my all my laminates from like the really early days. And that one is on there. I see it all the time. It's awesome.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, it's like a ripoff of Eddie, like the Iron Maiden Killers.
Oh, is that what you guys were?
That's
what,
makes sense. That's what it was. It was a ripoff of Killers, like Eddie. And then we tried to do the robot kind of as Eddie.
Okay.
And then I think we put a beanie. We call them toques in Canada. A beanie on his head, and then we called it Bros in the Snow, which as I recall, it was a cold tour. So.
I do remember, you know, being on that tour, and it was,
Well, then, you know, fast forward to 2011, we do it again. You know, you guys are direct support to us this time. And I felt like seconds after that tour ended, something like, boom, something happened and you guys just exploded. and I really want to know what happened. Like, what the hell happened? Why did it take so long? And then what was it that just all of a sudden clicked? That was like, okay, like all these people know about our band all of a sudden, and everyone loves us, and like,
right?
What was that? Because it's very, very rare to have that happen, you know, on a whenever that late into a band's career. You know?
Well, what happened basically is we put out our record Collide with the Sky, which was, you know, became like our breakthrough, you know, quote unquote breakthrough record, where, you know, whatever, right place, right time, right songs, right whatever.
Right tours, yeah.
Right tours. It was the record just caught on with our fans, and you know, it was like at the time where we had done enough of the work. Like, we had worked our asses off touring every single place, you know, like over and over and over, and opening, and finally, you know, there was. Enough people knew who we were that when we put out a record, you know, they got it, you know, and they heard it. And, so that was like the groundwork. And then once it came out, we were, we kind of hit the ground running with a single King for a Day the featured Kellen Quinn from Sleeping with Sirens. And, we put that song out right before Warped Tour, and we did it on Warped Tour, and then it kind of went from there, but I don't know. That was just kind of the record that kind of kicked off. And most people, you know, at that time, that might've been some people, that was like the first thing they ever heard of our band. And, you know, they're like, oh, who's this new band? And we're like, well, actually we've been touring for like 6 years or, you know, I don't know. It was crazy.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I asked... I asked a couple of, you know, the fans of the podcast and stuff to, you know, I always let them know, oh, this is a guest happening, some of the VIPs, and do you have any questions? And it's funny because one of my big fans, Brendan Potter, he asked, I'll read you the question. He asked you this. He goes, what's it like becoming one of the most popular bands in the scene? They become the face of the scene for some of these younger people. My stepsister is a junior in high school, 11 years younger than me, absolutely hated my music growing up. Now Pierce the Veil is her favorite band. She was blown away when I told her I saw Vic live with Cinematic Sunrise, Daphne Loves Derby, and My American Heart back in like 07. Yes. She actually found Pierce the Veil after their Conan appearance. She's now head over heels into the scene, and they're her favorite band. Do you guys get that sense? And if so, is there pressure added to it? That's his question. And it's relevant to what we're talking about, you know, with where you guys are now.
Yeah. Man, yeah, that's crazy. That's a lot to think about right there.
Sorry, it was a long, very long-winded question from Brendan Potter.
Yeah, so many emotions just came up for me in that question.
Daphne
like, oh.
Loves Derby. That's a band I haven't thought about in a minute. Damn.
Yeah. Oh, man. I don't know, man. Like I said, it's just kind of been such a slow rise for us, like that. I think we've always just kind of, been ready and comfortable for every like kind of step that our band has taken. You know, it's like from starting to headline to doing bigger headliners to, you know, finally doing like festivals and so I don't know. It's just, I don't know. Well, like, well, I guess I can just say like, you know, kind of get as we go here. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to answer
well,
that
that's
one.
Fine. I mean, yeah, it's a lot to take in, but I mean, do you think that this slow rise to where you've gotten has kind of kept you a little more grounded? And I mean, obviously your personality is your personality, and I've known you a long time and you've always been a great guy and very humble.
Thanks, dude. All right, back at you.
Well, thanks, man. But I mean, you gotta wonder, like, the fact that it wasn't like your first record, boom, like King for a Day or whatever song is like blowing up and you know, you're on the radio and you're on MTV and all, like, you guys really, it's like all of a sudden you look back and like, it's kind of like what you said about enjoying, taking time to enjoy the moment, because you've always just been like, okay, we achieved this little thing. What's next? What's next? What's next? And now it's like, now you're just like, okay, well, I'm the same guy. We're just... You know, I can rent a better Airbnb now, you know?
Totally. That is literally what I do now.
I've been reading about you. Yes, that's a question I want to ask you.
Now, I guess, I don't know how to sort of can answer that. So I guess I think along the way, you know, having such a, you know, long career in this band, like so far, you know, like in the slow rise, is like, it's all about, I guess we had the luxury of learning from a lot of mistakes and learning from a lot of bands. And, you know, every bigger band that we toured with, we picked something up, whether it was something awesome that band or something super shitty that band did. You know what I mean?
Like, sorry, and, if you're talking about us.
No, we are never talking about you guys. No, we, you know, like, you know, I remember like one of the first like quote unquote like big tour for us was going out with Scary Kids, Scaring Kids, and Emery, and
wow, yeah,
and Emery was the headlining band, and I think they might have been, but anyways, we learned a lot from them because you know, they treated us like really well and really kind of took note that, you know, we were you know, a young band who didn't really know what we were doing, and you know, they would get us a hotel for the night sometimes, or like,
wow,
or buy
yeah.
us all dinner or something like that, have a pizza party, you know, and those little things kind of like stuck with us, and then we would tour with sometimes we would tour with bands who would do really shitty things and you know, and like treat everyone like really, really bad, and then we would be like, we don't ever want to do that to people, you know, like we're going to strike the drums if the stage is too small, you know what I mean?
Right.
If they need to have room on stage, we're going to leave room for the openers, like stuff like that.
Isn't
you know, was, was, uh,
Isn't it amazing, the whole striking the drums thing? Like, first of all, how bent out of shape some people get about it.
Yeah, somebody can write a whole book on striking the drums.
It's crazy. Honestly. Yeah, for people that don't know, we should talk about striking the drums. It's such a great topic. And for people listening that might not know what that means, it's like when you go to a show and there's the opening bands, a lot of times you'll see up on the back riser, there'll be a drum kit. Hopefully it's covered with a black sheet, but sometimes it won't be. And it's basically a huge, I mean, eyesore for the opening bands playing. That's the first thing. And the second thing is there's really not a lot of room on stage for the opening bands to play in front of. And sometimes bands, if you're in a huge venue, like the venues we were in Australia, for example, like these are stages are huge. Like it was never a problem. Like we were fine.
You can
playing
fit five,
in front.
Five drum sets.
Exactly.
There.
It's no problem.
Yeah.
But when you play like certain, you know, venues with tiny stages and these bands still think they can't strike their drums, they need to leave them up. And like, you know, when a singer has to pick a side to stand on, you know, it's it can be really horrible, and it can really, really put a rift between headlining bands and opening bands.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, it was, you know, when I've got Mike's kick drum like in my ass and I'm like trying to like perform up there and I'm tiptoeing around,
right?
Tiptoeing around on stage, and there's only 1 foot of stage up there. It's like that was a thing like back then, you know, like
absolutely. I mean,
I'm sure it still is, you know. And so you know, those were the things that you know, you remembered, like, and you know, so we kind of take all that with us still.
My favorite striking the drum story ever.
Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure it's 100% true, and I'm not going to change the names of the bands. So I believe it was Chiodos was headlining, and they played. It was a pretty big tour, so they were kind of getting used to not striking their drums. But there was a few shows where like they really should have, and they didn't. And one of them, they were playing at the Cat's Cradle in North Carolina. You probably played there before, and I guess. Whoever it was, I guess Dan from the Devil Wears Prada. That's who was opening for them. The Devil Wears Prada put up his drums in front of Derek, I guess, you know, Derek, drummer for Chiodos.
Yeah.
And his kick drum was literally overhanging the stage.
Like, oh, no.
So he's like, yeah, like, this isn't going to work, man. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And the Chiodos crew was like, oh, no, it's fine. And they went and they pushed like road cases in front of the stage to make the stage a little bit bigger.
Wow.
So that the drum, like the, you know, whatever they're called, like they're called like the drum pegs, you know, that stick into the ground.
Yeah.
Drum legs. I don't even know what they're called. Yeah. So that they were like, you know, against the road case, like that was on the floor.
They built more stage for
they
you.
They built, well, very, very sketchy. Like there's no way that would have been. And yeah, and
very
then Mike
dangerous
had to,
stage.
Mike from Prada had to pick a side, and that was,
wow.
So that's my favorite. But it's, you know, people listening, like they understand that those are the things when someone's shit talking a band, it can be just something like that that can really be a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah, I remember, honestly, I have the same exact thing happen with on Chiodos when we're out with Scary Kids. They wouldn't strike their ego risers, which are the, you know, the people out there who don't know what that is. It's the thing that, you know, the guitar players stand on.
We call them rock boxes. That's
rock
what we call
boxes.
Them.
But, yeah, but ego risers.
Ego risers is like such a funny term for them.
I know,
it's like literally that's
but what worked
lead singer
out
syndrome,
with,
you know?
The thing that worked out nicely about that name, though, was they had so they decided not to strike their ego risers, and they left them all over the stage. And then they posted these paper like notifications on all the tours backstage that said ego risers are for Chiodos only, and we weren't allowed to step on them, or so we had to dance around them and kind of like try and perform with these things all over the stage. And I remember,
wow, that's crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah, I remember Puyon from Scary Kids. He crossed out the word riser and it said egos are for Chiodos only all over the venue, and it caused this big like problem. We had to have a big talk, but it was, I thought it was pretty great.
Yeah, Puyon would do that.
Yeah,
I miss
he
that
was great.
Guy, man. He was always climbing on shit and everything. He would.
Oh my god!
I could definitely see that being a problem for him, not being able to step places on the stage.
The first day I met that guy, I remember he. They were the first band I ever saw with a bus, And
oh yeah,
he like first day I met him, he like made a big entrance, like jumped out of his bus, like hanging on to the door like a like Tarzan, and like did some weird like fucking flip thing. And I was like, what the fuck? This guy's crazy. Yeah, he's
That's
great.
That's crazy, man. That's crazy. Well, I want to talk a bit about you and your songwriting, because it's very also well known. The first thing we talked about was how it took like 4 years or whatever for Misadventures to come out. But, mm-hmm. you know, even back in the day, you know, you went, I think it was a long time between the first and the second record. And mm-hmm. maybe it was someone from EVR that was saying, yeah, like Vic just takes a long time to write. That's just his style. And, you know, you've almost become a bit of a notorious perfectionist. So talk to me how that works, because I know you also do co-writes too. But mm-hmm. but why does it take so long for you to put together records?
I think, well, it's weird, dude, because like every record is completely different process. And, you know, it's like, for me, it can never really be the same. I've never been, you know, the kind of writer that just goes in there and bangs out like, you know, 10 songs in a week, you know, like, I think another thing that takes a long time is, you know, I spend a lot of time on the music first, you know, making all these like, you know, tons of guitar riffs. I love to mess around with guitar and really make the songs have a lot of like feeling and emotion without even putting a single word on it. You know, so like when you hear a song without words, you're like feeling things and you're like, damn, this is like a sad part, or this is like really pumping me up, or like, you know, so
interesting. I
spent a ton of time, you know, locked away in different, you know, houses and cabins and fucking, you know, just finding different places to work and writing songs that way. And then later I go back and I, you know, put lyrics to them, that also lyrics. And I spent a ton of time writing lyrics you know, I don't know. It's just, it's always been like a, you know, painting a picture for me. It's like, you know, you just kind of know when it's finished. You know, I don't know how a painter ever goes, all right, that's the last brush stroke. You know what I mean? It's like, that's kind of how it is for me. I just kind of feel it, you know?
I definitely understand that with a record. And for generally, like with recording, like a, you know, a studio album, I find the last paint stroke is done when we ran out of time, you know, like you pretty much you're going to use the studio time. You're going to have like pretty much all of it. Like we've done records where we spent like an obscene amount of time tracking. Like I think we did one record that we did like 8 full weeks or something tracking, like, you know, and we used it all because we had the time. Yeah. And then there's other records that's like, oh, you only have, you know, 4.5 weeks. Okay, well, you know, we use that too. So, but I want to go back to what you just said about writing music and focusing on music. And like, do you not even think about what the vocals are going to do when you're writing, or do you have it kind of in the back of your head, or not even?
I do. You know, I write a lot of melodies, in the beginning and, you know, and lyrics here and there. Most of the songs end up having, for me, end up having like complete melodies, like the song is there with a bunch of gibberish, like da 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 da, you know, like what I mean, like it's all in there ready for words and stuff, and I kind of have it all mapped out the way I want it to be, and then later I kind of like put words to what I've, you know, to these melodies that I've got in mind already, and it's sort of a backwards weird way to do it, but I've always done it like that because I've always like kind of been a guitar player first, you know, always just learned that way. And I was super relieved when I was watching this Metallica documentary and I learned that James Hetfield did the same exact thing. And I was like, oh, thank God I'm not like an complete insane person for doing this, you know?
And Vic, like I do the same thing too. Like that's how I write songs too. I've like focused on the music and I try to make the music good and catchy. And it's like, I know if the music is good and it makes sense, like musically, mm-hmm. and like the rhythms are working and everything, then I know I'm going to be able to pull it together.
Yeah.
With vocal. Hell it's just like, if it's just like as a guitar player, it's pretty easy to write a lead over mm-hmm. like, you know, a musical part that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's the same way, because all you're doing with writing vocals essentially is you're writing a lead.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And for me, like, you know, on this most recent record, it was like I had the whole record on a silver platter, like waiting for me, like to sing on it for months. And I think I had hit a point when I was doing this record where I had worked so hard on the music and been in the studio for so long, like that, I honestly had overworked myself, and I was like, I need to take a little break, or I need to leave the studio and go to a different environment or something, you know, cause when it came to do vocals, I was just pretty overworked and pretty, you know, needed to see some friends and some,
right,
just and, like kind of recharge for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Cause I was living in, the studio by myself in New York, in Long Island. And there was like nothing around, and I was there for like months, just kind of like on my own working on the music and trying to.
Was it like winter time too?
Yeah, it was like winter, you know.
Yeah, that's tough for a San Diego kid, I guess.
It was crazy, you know. And I was like living there because the band had gone home once they'd finished their part. So I think mentally I just got in like a really, just stressed out state, I was really, you know, I was in love with the songs. I love the song so much. And honestly, it has a lot to do with, I guess just wherever my head was as a person, like growing, you know, we all are growing up doing this thing, and we're not the same kids that we were when we first started our bands. You know, we're growing up as adults and men. And I think, I was probably just kind of going through something growing up, you know, and it was like a phase in my life that I was trying to finish this record, but I was also kind of battling things in my head, and I think that all had a lot to do with it. So
yeah, man. No, that's crazy. So you took a little bit of time then and then came back and wrote the vocals?
Yeah, well, actually what we actually went on tour for a little bit to kind of just take a breather and kind of see our fans and remind us that, you know, this is what you do. This is your,
wow, yeah.
You know, this is the stuff you love. And so we played some shows. And then I went back and kind of came in with a different headspace and instead of staying in one little studio, I decided to travel around a lot and move my brain around a lot, you know, go to different little houses and different studios. And it all kind of helped, the little mental space I needed to finish the record.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny, man. I can relate too. I'll sit on my couch, you know, at night in an evening, you know, and I'll be like, okay, gotta write some lyrics. And like, I'll sit there for like 4 or 5 hours, and if I write like 2 or 3 lines that I'm happy with, that's like a success for me.
Yeah, totally. I was the same way, you know, when I was making this record, I would, you know, every single line counts, every single note counts, and it's like, to you, it's like, you're hoping that this is the greatest thing you've ever created in your life. You know what I mean? That's what you're trying to do. You know, I mean, at least that's what I'm trying to do. I don't know. Like with every record, I'm trying to, you know, put the best of what all these years of being a songwriter and being, you know, making songs, like this is going to be the best thing we've done. And so, man, like every time you do have that little victory, they all are like little victories of like coming up with like the perfect, you know, part for the bridge. You're like, oh yeah, this is going to be great live. You know, you can't wait to do it.
Records get harder to make, man. They just do. It's true. And I think there's a combination of not running out of ideas. That's not the right word. But it's like you're writing Pierce the Veil songs. You don't want to write the same one over and over again. So you have to continue to, you know, try to come up with original ideas. But at the same time, as you get older, there's more and more things in your life. There's more and more obligations. You know, when you're making your first or second record, no one's like, your manager isn't calling you. Hi, Michelle, by the way. I love your manager. She's amazing.
Yeah.
Your manager isn't calling you being like, oh, yeah, so we got to figure out the stage plot for this and, like, what kind of, you know, backline are we getting in, on this tour? Or like, you know, there's all these distractions too that I don't want to say they come into play, but that's probably why you can need to lock yourself away, you know, in a ranch or Airbnb or whatever it is somewhere to kind of block that out. And that's, to me, like, I mean, I think records get harder. Do you agree with me?
I think I do agree with what you're saying. You know, as you're a band longer, like your responsibilities as a band are tremendous. You know, like if you're still like, you know, trying to grow and do crazier things, you know, you're, like you said, it's like, you know, what are we doing for this next tour? You know, let's approve this and that and whatever, you know, when you run your own show, you know, like we do, and it seems like you guys do as well, you know, it's you've got a lot, more moving parts and stuff. And when you make your first record, when you're a kid, you have your whole life to make that record. Like you've been, you know, working in your bedroom, you know, relentlessly making that record. So, you know, every process is different. And I also think, I always look at every record as a bit of a time capsule, like whatever was happening in your life during that, you know, 2-3 years, is what gets down on paper. And, if you, you know, whatever's going on in your life is what you're going to write about, you know? If you've got really crazy things going on in your life, you're going to end up writing about them.
sure.
I think on this last record, I had kind of just dove deep into the record. So,
Yeah, man. I want to ask you a couple things. My one question I wanted to ask you, because I'm selfish, is, you know, we talked earlier about your love for punk rock, and you grew up with punk rock. And one of my favorite things about your band is how much you still incorporate that influence into your music. And it's funny because not a lot of bands, you know, in the scene or whatever you want to call it, are really doing that, like having double time parts. And not only do you guys still do it, you do it really well, and kids like eat it up. And like, it's cool because it like works for me and it works for kids somehow. But is that something you think about at all?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always figured that every young kid who likes, you know, music is going to like fast music, you know, because that's what, I mean, I just have a theory that fucking everyone's going to fucking love it when they're young. Like I loved it when I was young. Like it had to be fast or else I didn't really like it.
Oh, God, you know? Me too, man. If it didn't have like, you know, if it wasn't mostly double time, like I used to skip the like regular time songs. I wanted
totally.
I needed that.
Yeah, it's like, it's like more aggressive. It's, you know, you can go crazy to it. Like your parents hate it.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, and, that's what I loved. And, I just don't see that ever really dying. You know, I feel like there will always be some sort of need for that aggression and for that fast, beat. And my brother, Mike, who's our drummer, you know, being, just so ingrained in that music, like it's his bread and butter. He can, you know, that's what he grew up playing, and he's probably one of I think one of the best fast drummers out there, you know. And it's really great, you know, playing that music with him,
absolutely.
Because, you know, him and I really lock in on it and love doing it together. So yeah, man, it's you know, and it is very like self-indulgent too, because it's so fun for us, you know.
Exactly.
I love doing it.
Exactly. Well,
yeah, man,
you feel free to be self-indulgent just for me, because I love that aspect of your band. It's like one of my favorite things.
Thanks,
I also want to ask you before you go, and ask you about your vocal, your style. Have you sing very high, and you do a lot of vocal exercises. Has that been something, like, do you have to do vocal exercises? Because I've heard you like warm up for like an hour at least before you play. Like, is it kind of a combination of you can sing high because you've done so many vocal exercises, or do you have to do a lot of vocal exercises because you sing so high?
I honestly don't know. It's like, I remember I actually sang lower when I was younger for some reason, like, which is probably not really the way it's supposed to go. But, you know,
maybe the vocal exercises have helped.
Dude, I honestly, you know, you and I both grew up in the time when there was a certain time of our genre where it was, if you couldn't sing high, you weren't shit. Like, it was like you, that was the goal, was all these singers were trying to sing like super high, like
right.
Circus Survive and, you know, or Seos and, you know, to start off, you know, Kyoto is like everybody like loves singing these, you know, high and so I started kind of reaching up in my range and realized that I could hit these notes and stuff. And so, and it actually kind of, it felt comfortable for me, you know, that's kind of where my voice feels like I'm getting something interesting out of it is when I kind of push it. And, you know, my mom will tell you the exact opposite. She loves when I sing like low and chill, but, you know, she's always like, why don't you just sing lower? And I'm like, it doesn't sound cool. You know,
it's funny. Yeah. So, that's funny.
But I don't know, man, it's just, and I do, have to take care of my voice a lot on tour. And, there's a lot of, you know, things that I do to keep it in tact and stuff. Cause all these songs are very, you know, when you're doing like an hour and a half of songs that are basically pushing your
top of your ear,
yeah, your voice, at the, you know, maximum capabilities at all times, it's not easy. So, you have to definitely take care of it. And,
what's the one thing you do? What's the one thing that you do that you think is the most important?
Sleep.
Oh yeah, sleep. Really?
Yeah. Honestly, number one for me that I've learned over the years is if I, you know, if you sleep enough, you're basically kind of rehealing. You know, that's like when your body heals itself is when you're sleeping. You know, and resting. I try to make sure, you know, that I, you know, before every show, you know, that night before, I get like a good, really good sleep. And it really helps me not lose my voice, you know, in a tour, you know, 'cause that's the goal, is to like get through the entire tour without losing your voice. And,
yeah.
Yeah, man. All right. It can be super hard when you're traveling so much. And, you know, I've tried everything, tried all the, you know, vaporizers and steam inhalers and, yeah, you know, sprays and whatever, you know, vitamins and water and this and that. And I found that the best thing is just to make sure you get enough rest.
It's crazy. So, that's crazy. Is it hard when you go to like Australia? I mean, we were there together. You were fine in Australia, but it must be hard when you have to deal with jet lag where you're not able to just be like, okay, I'm going to sleep for 8 hours in a row or whatever.
Yeah, no, it is, you know, it's super, crazy when you're flying a lot. And, yeah, man, those are the hardest times. I think when you have to do a lot of flying and stuff like that, it's tough because, you know, that's a whole part of it. You know, that staying healthy as a singer is important, you know?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Well, yeah. Thank you so much. One final question. What do you think about the Chargers, leaving San Diego?
It's pretty sad. You know, I think the thing that hit me the hardest was, you know, a friend of mine made a post of like being like, you know, no more tailgating with my friends and my family, you know, no more, parties at, you know, our house, like where everybody comes over and kind of has those kind of family friend times,
right,
of like come together. You know, and for me, I was like thinking like in the future, like, you know, my dad took me to all these games when I was a kid and, you know, I won't be able to do that. And it, you know, so it's a, you know, we still have the Padres, which is, you know, cool.
Absolutely.
So,
you signed Will Myers today.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's kind of a bummer in the, you know, family friend, zone, you know, but, you know, we will press on. We'll be all right.
You'll be all right. Yes, you will, San Diego. You stay classy now. Thank you, Vic. You're the best, man. Thanks for doing this.
Dude.
And I hope to see you around soon.
Hell yeah, man. Thank you so much. This is awesome. And it was good catching up with you, man.
Great, man. Yeah, thanks, man. Take care.
All right. Later, Shane.
Cheers. Bye. So there is my conversation with Vic. Such a great guy. It's amazing how we have so much in common. He actually sent me a text after the interview and said something like, talking to you is like looking in the mirror or something. And first thing I thought is he's way better looking than me. But, you know, hey, whatever. Thanks again, everybody, so much for listening to this. Make sure you're subscribed. If you dig the show, word of mouth is really what's helped this thing grow so far. So tell your brother, tell your sister, tell your aunt, tell your uncle, whatever. Post about it on social media. You know, help spread the word about this thing. And if this is your first time listening to the show, go back. We got like 60 more episodes. Check those out. And make sure you're subscribed. So all that stuff is coming right at you. As always on the show, I will leave you with some music. Now, there's a lot of Pierce the Veil songs I like. There's a lot of good jams. I have picked this one specifically for selfish purposes, as this is my favorite Pierce the Veil song. And I like it, kind of like we talked about in the podcast, I like it because it's a fast as fuck punk rock song. So here it is. Texas is Forever on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love, and we'll see you next week.